Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who assesses Arab reaction to the U.S. war in Iraq and the dangerous fallout it may set off. Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, who considers the ethical issues surrounding the U.S. justification for war on Baghdad and the role of citizens when their government defies international law and adopts repressive measures. And Ohio Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, who explains why he opposes the Iraq war and his changing position on abortion as he runs for the White House. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
USA Today reports there is a small but growing group of military resistors opposed to fighting in Iraq. Marine reservist Trevor Clark pledged to refuse to go to Iraq if his reserve unit is called up. "This war is wrong," declared Clark, 25, who has a year left on his reserve contract. Last year, 29 people were discharged from the military as conscientious objectors in a voluntary force of 2.7 million active and reserve troops. Now peace groups say the number of calls to counseling centers has skyrocketed. Physician Dave Wiggins was given a dishonorable discharge and a $25,000 fine after he refused to serve in the first Persian Gulf War. At the time, he was denied conscientious objector status and then went on a hunger strike. Now Wiggins is talking to active military personnel about how to avoid war. In recent weeks, former Army Reserve Staff Sergeant Michael Sudbury called a press conference in Salt Lake City to publicly declare his refusal to serve in the war on Iraq. As Michael Simmons of the American Friends Service Committee noted, "I know these young kids are going to suffer for years to come, if they are lucky enough to come out alive." Iran is the second pillar of George Bush's axis of evil. But in recent months, the White House, obsessed with taking out Saddam Hussein, has played softball with Iran's hardline clerics and remained silent about the repression of Iran's popular reform movement. According to the news magazine In These Times, Islamic hardliners in Tehran, who control security forces, have cooperated with the American war in Afghanistan, and the Bush administration is hoping for more quiet cooperation in the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. Meanwhile, the mullahs have led a major crackdown on dissent and opposition reform parties. One prominent activist, Hashem Agaga, a reformer close to President Mohammad Khatami, was sentenced to death for declaring that Muslims should use reason and not blindly follow the dictates of the mullahs. Sayed Ali Asghar Garavi of the banned Iran Freedom Movement insists the U.S. is protecting and providing clandestine support to right-wing conservatives in Iran. After the 9/11 attacks, President Khatami and Iran's reformers tried to engage the Bush administration by condemning terrorist groups worldwide, and one of the students who seized the U.S. embassy in 1979 apologized. At the time, reformers were looking for some sign that the U.S. was ready for closer relations with Iran. Instead, President Bush brandished Iran as a key link in the axis of evil. Yet the Bush administration is risking a major backlash by the Iranian public, who have consistently voted for reform and closer ties to the West. In the minds of many observers, the 1979 Islamic Revolt was a delayed response to the 1953 coup engineered by the CIA. A new wave of anti-Americanism could greet any U.S. alliance with repressive forces in Iran. A recent report from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's online publication, Technology Review, paints a picture of the future that resembles a science fiction novel. "We may be approaching an age when individuals can no longer expect to be in any public space without being videotaped." The security market research firm J.P. Freeman has established that there are already 26 million surveillance cameras around the world, including more than 11 million in the United States. However, London, England is leagues ahead of its American counterpart when it comes to surveillance. Hull University criminologist Clive Norris estimates that the average person is filmed in London by more than 300 cameras each day. As the threat of terrorism looms, surveillance technologies have profited. The global biometric market generated $66 million in revenue in 2000 and is likely to reach $900 million by 2006. the results of the intensified monitoring could have disastrous effects on public life and privacy rights. The U.S. Defense Department's Total Information Awareness Office will focus its efforts on building a master database using credit information and face recognition technology in an attempt to identify criminals and terrorists. According to Technology Review, the data pool is large and flawed, and conclusions drawn from it are difficult to verify. Civil liberties advocates charge that the system is an invasion of privacy with the potential to be abused by authorities and could subject citizens to false arrests. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In defiance of majority opinion in the United Nations and around the world, President Bush, along with Britain, his sole military ally, launched their war to overthrow the Iraqi government by conducting one of the fiercest aerial missile attacks in military history. But the so-called shock-and-awe bombing campaign against Baghdad and other Iraqi cities has thus far failed to reduce Saddam Hussein's will to fight or force his regime's surrender. In fact, U.S. and British forces have faced stiff resistance in southern Iraq, a section of the country they had expected to easily subdue on their way to attack the heavily fortified capital city of Baghdad. U.S. television networks have broadcast images of Iraqi prisoners of war in U.S. custody, but the Bush administration has claimed that similar broadcasts by Iraqi TV of interviews with American POWs constitutes a violation of the Geneva Convention. And there are many critics of this war who point out that the U.S. itself stands in naked violation of the United Nations Charter and international law. Opponents of the war have long warned that a U.S. attack on Iraq could trigger unintended consequences, including new instability in the Middle East and an increase of support among Arabs and Muslims for anti-American terrorist groups. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, communications director with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who assesses likely civilian casualties in the war and Arab reaction.
This entirely avoidable conflict has two principal problems with it, apart from its avoidability and its inconsistency with the UN Charter and with any resolution of the United Nations. The first is the obvious threat of death and devastation that it brings to the long-suffering Iraqi people, who's endured two major recent wars, a 10-year war with Iran and, of course, the first Gulf War, and a decade of unprecedented international sanctions, which have caused so much death and devastation there as well. And, of course, living for decades under this ghastly, foul dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, which really is one of the cruelest in the world. So, you know, to see a people who suffered like that then be subjected to further bombing and killing and what have you in the name of their own liberation, I think is just very heartrending for anyone who cares at all about the Iraqi people. The second problem with it, of course, is that it threatens very much to create more problems than it solves, particularly the long-term political repercussions of this. I mean, you couldn't really come up with a scenario better designed to give a sudden and undeserved burst of credibility to the ravings of Osama bin Laden. I mean, he's been going around the past 10 years trying to convince the Arabs generally that they're under a collective and generalized assault by people he describes as crusaders and Jews, meaning the United States and Israel. And now we have this spectacle of what most people around the world, and certainly most Arabs, regard as a totally unjustified United States attack on Iraq, dovetailing with an ongoing Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. And I think that this spectacle of war and occupation in Iraq with the United States and war and occupation in Palestinian territories with Israel, will, I think, in the minds of way too many people, for my comfort anyway, play into the hands of these despicable lunatics. And so I think those and numerous other negative political ramifications indicate that whatever potential benefits this war could bring in terms of ridding the Iraqi people of the foul tyrant Saddam Hussein, that those costs, in terms of death and devastation on the one hand, and in terms of political damage to the world and to the regional system that the Iraqis live in, is, really excessive.
What are some of your concerns about civilian casualties? It seems that the U.S. Armed Forces, the White House, and even media commentators are going out of their way to explain how precise U.S. weapons are and how they there may be large explosions and fireballs on the horizon of Baghdad. But it's interesting to hear these commentators reassuring the public watching these grotesque images that civilians are not being harmed in this process.
Yeah, of course, we've heard that before, haven't we? I really think that this is kind of magical wishful thinking. I think it is probably true. I mean, it's undoubtedly true that American missiles and some bombs are much more accurate than they were before, and that there has been, you know, a generalized technological improvement. But I think that the fallacy of smart weapons is in spite of those improvements is as deep now as it was in 1991. The simple fact is that if you go into a country and toss around hundreds of thousands of pounds of explosives from a distance, you are going to end up killing large numbers of people. First of all, the precision weapons are not that precise. They go astray. I mean, a passenger bus filled with Syrian civilians was hit. 2 days ago, three Tomahawks went careening straight into Iran, causing chagrin and consternation in both cases, obviously. So even if the weapons were, completely precise, it's still fallible, stupid human beings who program and point them. And then, of course, the weapons are not that precise. And then, of course, not all the weapons even have this technology attached to it. And finally, the emphasis on these weapons, frankly, is part of a plan that isn't panning out at all, which is the plan of shock and awe, the plan to weaken the government by a combination of, massive display of military might that we've been seeing and an elaborate campaign of psychological warfare designed to discredit the government and convince the military and the administrative apparatus and the lower echelons even of the government, perhaps, of the party, that is, to abandon Saddam Hussein and, refuse to fight and possibly even bump him off in a coup, what have you. So we should not really buy into any of these myths, whether it's the myth of precision weapons or the myth of the war the way Rumsfeld has described it, or the myth that, in the end, Iraqis are just going to be so grateful for all of this, they're not going to care about the death and devastation that's raining down on them.
That was Hussein Ibish, Communications Director with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Contact the committee at area code 202-244-2990 or visit the group's website at www.adc.org. As President Bush ordered the first air attacks against Iraqi cities, protesters took to the streets in legal and civil disobedience actions around the U.S. and abroad to express their opposition to a war that much of the world views as unjust and unnecessary. In response, right-wing politicians and conservative commentators have branded those opposing the Bush administration's war as unpatriotic and traitors. Meanwhile, the Clear Channel Radio Network, whose vice chairman has close ties to the president, has organized what they call Rallies for America in many cities to support U.S. troops. Clear Channel, a giant conglomerate which built their empire on deregulation of the radio industry, is looking to the White House for support to further loosen the rules governing broadcasters. Although the U.N. Security Council refused to authorize an invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration claims that U.N. resolutions from the first Persian Gulf War in 1991 and the more recent resolution 1441 provided all the legitimacy they needed to initiate hostilities. After the war began, the White House boasted they had 35 coalition partners, most of whose populations opposed this war, with only Britain, Australia, and a few others sending their soldiers to fight Saddam Hussein's regime. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University, who has closely examined the toll taken by 12 years of U.N. economic sanctions on the people of Iraq. Here, Gordon considers the ethical questions surrounding the U.S. justification for war and the role of citizens when their government defies international law and adopts repressive measures.
The U.N. Charter, devised at the end of World War II, in the way the League of Nations was, both come after the human catastrophes of two world wars, and both are envisioning structures that will be very, very strict in restraining aggression between nations. So the UN Charter says no member state may interfere with the may violate the territorial integrity or political independence of another member nation. And the only exception to that, one is under Chapter 7, which has to do with breaches with peace, aggression, and threats to the peace. And the other is Article 51, which has to do with self-defense against armed attack. And if one of those two is not the case, if it's not authorized by the Security Council as a response to aggression on behalf of the institution of the UN, not by individual nations, and if it's not self-defense in response to armed attack, then it is aggression. It is precisely what the UN Charter was designed to prevent.
What is the obligation of a citizen in a nation whose government is breaking international law?
Well, on one hand, this is a time when I feel quite proud to be an American, as I, you know, was in New York on Saturday and marching, and the tremendous passion and intensity of those marchers, and that seems to me to be a democratic expression. When Congress fails to represent the will of the people, when the executive fails to represent the will of the people, then that is something Americans can do, is to protest in a very active way. The other thing that we have to give thought to is how much the way the Bush administration and the press have framed the issues has really sort of permeated our consciousness and very much sort of shaped our sensibilities. And not just in the case of the war against Iraq, but if we look at the USA Patriot Act and the racism and xenophobia that's engendered, the idea of holding prisoners in Guantanamo and deciding quite by fiat that they are neither prisoners of war subject to the protections of the Geneva Convention nor criminals subject to the protections of the U.S. Constitution, but some third category which is not subject to any protections. The invention of a court to do that, the invention of a new form of military tribunal in which those charged have no access to attorneys, may have no access to see the evidence against them. So we should be quite sensitive to what this means about what a democracy is, or what a sound government is, or what a decent society is. And for many of us, these things don't touch us personally. If you don't look Arab, then you may not have problems getting on planes. You'll merely be inconvenienced and be told to take your shoes off with a metal detector. I'd like to read, if I could, a kind of a lengthy quote from a book by Milton Meyer called They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1938 through 45. It's describing the sense of what it was to be German in the 1930s and the sense of sort of how increasingly aberrant the society was becoming, and at the same time, how difficult it was to wonder when it would be very clear, where it would be clear to everyone how aberrant it was. From a book by Milton Meyer called They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1938 through 45. It runs like this. Nazism gave us some dreadful fundamental things to think about, and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crises and so fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies without and within that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, that unless one understood that the whole thing was in principle what all these little measures must lead to someday, no one more saw it developing day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. Each act is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. And it's not just fear that restrains you, it's also genuine uncertainty. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. But the one great shocking occasion, when tens or hundreds of thousands will join with you, never comes. That's the difficulty. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, has changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things your father could never have imagined.
That was Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University. Her article, Cool War, Economic Sanctions as Weapons of Mass Destruction, appeared in the November 2002 edition of Harper's Magazine, which can be read online at www.harpers.org. In the midst of the U.S. war against Iraq, Ohio Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich was awarded the Gandhi Peace Award on March 22nd, given annually by the organization Promoting Enduring Peace to recognize individuals engaged in the struggle for peace. Kucinich was recognized for his efforts in Congress to stop the war in Iraq, which ironically started 3 days before he received the prize, as well as for his ongoing campaign advocating the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Peace. Kucinich, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, led the fight in the House of Representatives last fall against legislation authorizing President Bush to use force in Iraq. Though he and his allies lost that vote, the tally was closer than many had predicted. More recently, Kucinich was one of the lead plaintiffs in an unsuccessful lawsuit to stop the war based on the lack of constitutional authority. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dennis Kucinich while he was in New Haven to accept the Gandhi Award. He explains why he opposes the Bush administration's war in Iraq and his changing views on abortion as he seeks the Democratic presidential nomination.
We're trying to repeal the authorization for war based on the fact that it was gained under false pretenses. That resolution was offered in a climate of assertion that Iraq somehow had nuclear capabilities or was trying to acquire nuclear capabilities and therefore represented an imminent threat. Mohammed El-Baradei, in his report to the UN, made it very clear that the report that Iraq was trying to procure uranium from Niger was a falsehood. Furthermore, the assertion that Iraq had something to do with 9/11 is not true.
Which more than half the American people, I guess, now believe is true, because that's what they've been told.
Well, consent can be manufactured, as we know. And how could that be, when you think about that, how could it be when Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 that so many people think Iraq did? Well, it's easy to understand why they think that. The administration has repeatedly implied, asserted, that Iraq was somehow related to 9/11. And the media, uncritically and irresponsibly, carried those statements, broadcast them to mass publics. So we have a condition where people believe what their government has told them. It is significant that notwithstanding the tremendous propaganda which the White House has put out about Iraq, that half the country doesn't believe it.
How is your mail, email and phone calls and other kind of mail from your constituents running on this issue, on the war?
Initially, it started out overwhelmingly opposed to the war. And I think what's happened is that there's been a slight shift of people who are beginning to believe that this is the right thing to do. There are many people who are not aware that the action which the United States is taking is illegal. First of all, it's illegal because Congress did not authorize war under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. It is Congress, not the President, who has a responsibility to move this country from a position of peace to war. It's illegal because the UN Charter requires that a decision to take action should be through the Security Council. A nation has a right to defend itself under Article 51. However, this nation is embarking on offense, not defense. So this action by the administration may receive temporary approval from the American public. But as the people of this country begin to understand that what is occurring in this is a shift in America's role in the world, and implications of that are so profound. The implications are that we are an aggressor nation and that we assume the right to strike anywhere at any time. Those vain assumptions belie the likelihood that other nations will do the same thing. So we are about to let the principle of war be unleashed around the world.
In terms of your presidential campaign, you have been anti-abortion throughout your career. What is your position now, and if it's changed, why?
In the last year, I made a decision to be very clear on the issue of criminalization. I've never been for criminalizing, and I feel that since the Congress, the majority, seems to be moving in a direction of repealing Roe v. Wade, that it's important to take a stance which protects Roe v. Wade, which then affirms a woman's right to choose. You know, I started out in public life wanting to do everything I could to affirm life, to take a holistic view of life. And I understand that my voting record over a period of a few years has reflected to some people consistency in that, but to others, it's raised questions as to whether I really understood the implications of any move that would make abortion illegal. I feel an obligation to make a statement in support of Roe v. Wade, in support of a woman's right to choose, as a fundamental constitutional right which should be secured for women, and at the same time continue my work to make abortions less necessary through prenatal care and postnatal care and child care and living wage and universal health care, and before you even get to that point, through sex education and contraception. Inside the Congress today, there are people who want to repeal Roe v. Wade, and I'm not going to go in that direction. I feel that a woman's right to choose has to be upheld. And as president, the issue of appointments to the Supreme Court. Generally speaking, a president would not want to have a litmus test on anything. However, when it comes to Roe v. Wade, with the court in such a close balance, I would not appoint anyone to the Supreme Court if they said that they would vote against Roe v. Wade.
That was Democratic Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich. Contact his campaign office at area code 866-413-3664 or visit his website at www.kucinich.us. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.